Well, I want to ask you some questions about yourself, and I'd like for you to put yourself in perspective for me in terms of your own life. And where were you born?
I was born in just outside of Boston, or a suburb of Boston, or a city next to Arlington, Massachusetts. And then family moved almost immediately out to the what was then the country, Acton, Massachusetts. And my father was a doctor in the Boston area, and sadly died when I was very young. So my mother went back to public health nursing, and I really grew up in this curious transitional farm town with the railroad coming through and the swimming hole and the, you know, all that feel. Now it's a, I went back a few years ago and counted 40 houses between the one I grew up in and the next farm down the way, so it's vastly changed.
What year were you born?
1926. A great year, the year of Bob Dylan, Allen Ginsberg, and Miles Davis, right?
Yeah. Where were you educated?
I was educated, primarily educated, in a small school in New England that I happily got a scholarship to as a kid called Holderness that really took me, you know, took me from a classic, solid, but very, very practical sort of high school education in this town I mentioned, wherein, say, it was lucky indeed if anyone went to college from that particular group. And so I managed to get a scholarship to a small school up in Plymouth, New Hampshire called Holderness, where I got this extraordinary old-time teaching in the late 30s, early 40s.
Now, this was college?
This was a...
Prep school?
This was so-called prep school.
What was the name of it?
Holderness. Holderness. I could give you the cry or whatever it would be called. Mm-hmm. But in any case, I went from there. I wanted to be a veterinarian, and then came the great moment of decision, just as it was now time to apply to various colleges. And I'd applied, I think, to Amherst and University of Pennsylvania as being terrific in their pre-vet preparation. But then I'd shyly applied also to Harvard. You know, anyone coming from Massachusetts has got to try at least. So, Harvard accepted me, as did these other two, with generous fellowships and scholarships in each case. But I determined that Harvard would be it, although they offered nothing but admission. And it was terrific. I, in one sense, had an argument with Harvard from the day I got there. But I found terrific company in the place. I mean, colleagues, classmates at that time were, Allison Lurie and John Hawks and Willie Gaddis and, you know, many, many different. Kenneth Koch was a particular friend there. Just an extraordinarily bright group of peers, all as variously frustrated, I suppose, as I was. I went to college during the war years. 43, and then I went in the American Field Service, then back, and finally dropped out toward the end of my senior year.
You dropped out?
Yeah. I remember the dean, I was living at that point, I'd married, my wife was momently to have a baby, and we were living in just outside of Provincetown in Truro, North Truro, and I was commuting to Harvard on the SS Chauncey Depew End or the old steel pier. These two commuter boats are actually pleasure boats and would arrive in Boston, sort of 3 hours of drinking beer on the boat and then wander off to classes. Anyhow, I was doing abysmally in my classes, and the dean called me in and suggested I take a leave because I was obviously overwrought, etc. And so I never got back to finish the degree. And finally, ten years later, I was in New Mexico and got an M.A. there, but otherwise that was it. Yeah.
You got an M.A., but you didn't get your B.A.?
No, I got an ostensible B.A. from Black Mountain College, where I taught for 2 years, just at the end of its existence.
Ostensible?
Yeah. Charles Olson was a very old and dear friend from that time. When I was applying to University of New Mexico, they said, you haven't finished the last of your undergraduate work, and so I needed an ostensible degree. So Olson said, insofar as I'd taught these courses, presumably I could pass them. So he generously gave me a B.A.
What were you studying at Harvard?
I was studying English. Anything that was labeled an English course, I took.
You gave up the idea of being a vet by this
time? Yeah, I did, desperately.
Thank God.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess nostalgia, that would have been a very different life. But I was really, once I was in Harvard and had, as I say, these extraordinary friends, I had also some great teachers there, F.O. Matthewson, for example, or Kenneth Murdoch, or Harry Levin was just settling in there, et cetera. But there were some very extraordinary teachers. There was also a very kind of muzzy tone as well. But I guess I was too ingenuous not to use the occasion as a more extensive preparation. I wish I'd taken history. I wish I'd taken sort of disciplines that would be far harder to manage on one's own.
What did you do when you dropped out of Harvard?
I was an insistent father and husband. Our family grew rapidly. We had subsequently about three children. We'd acquired a small farm in northern New Hampshire, near just outside of Littleton, New Hampshire. And we had some sense of subsistence farming. I guess we were predating the so-called beet generation by some years. And we were living in this lovely, idyllic old farm, derelict, but certainly idyllic, with something like 150 acres of utterly useless land, woods galore. And I was doing some ostensible farming, growing potatoes and beans, anything that could be stored over the winter or canned. And we had chickens and some things like that. We held on to the place desperately for about 3 years, and then we lost it through default of a payment. And at that point, friends in common, this was, say, after the war and whatnot, friends in common had migrated to France, actually, as being an inexpensive place to live. Particularly Denise Levertov and her husband had gone. We'd become friends. So we followed them over and lived, therefore, in France and in Mallorca for about 5 years, all told. And then back to this country where I taught then at Black Mountain, marriage fell apart, et cetera, et cetera.
During this early period, when you were on the farm, I presume you were launching a career at the time as a writer, or at least trying to.
I had a very determined sense of launching a career, and again, rather ingenuous, just that I determinedly wrote stories and sent them to the Esquire, let's say, or to magazines, presuming sooner or later I would have something accepted. And I did not Esquire, unhappily, but I did manage to get stories, and I got a story published by Kenyon, which was a great honor at the time. And it seemed for a time, in fact, that prose would be more particular to my abilities than poetry. But gradually, I guess almost because of the economy of poetry being, insofar as poems are shorter and mine are very short, I wrote more of them and had, I guess I simply developed more succinctly and more particularly as a poet. And my stories were, I loved them, but for the time, they were extraordinarily oblique. I remember the one that was taken by Kenyon. John Crow Ransom was then the editor, and had been on leave, actually, when the story was accepted, and came back and read it and couldn't understand it. He was a very sweet man indeed, and very supportive, and wrote me saying he would like, if it weren't offensive, some slight explanation of what the story was about. And he also sent me a comment by Robert Penn Warren, who was an advisory editor for the magazine, in which Warren is saying that he is constitutionally in favor of plot, and that he believes, and none of which my story much demonstrated. And he published it with great good faith, but I thought I was writing some very explicit tale of usual life, but the stories were coming out in this very gnarled and oblique manner, which I like, but I gather at the time it was extremely awkward for people to understand what in the name of heaven I was trying to tell them. Yeah.
What year did you begin at Black Mountain College?
1954, two years literally before the demise of the college.
So your first book came 2 years prior.
Prior to that.
So you must have been on Mallorca at the time.
Right? Yeah, we were living then on Mallorca, and that book was published by two graduate students at University of Ohio in Columbus.
Ohio State.
Yeah, they had a small press they called Golden Goose Press, and they published chapbooks and small collections and published a magazine called Golden Goose. And they published writers. Their great love, as mine was at the time, and continues to be, was William Carlos Williams. He was their great mentor, and they published a chapbook of his writing. The Pink Church was, I remember that, was an extraordinary book. And they also published Norman MacLeod, a poet of extraordinary ability who's now largely forgotten. He simply isn't as actively remembered as he was then. But It was a very pleasant press to be published by. You know.
Your book of short stories, Gold Diggers, that was printed privately.
Yeah, that was, well, it was printed by me and my dear wife at that time. There's a funny story apropos that Alex Trokey and Austin Wainhouse and Christopher Logue all were then young writers living in Paris with a magazine that I had much respect for called Merlin, and also they were publishing books under the imprint collection Merlin, so that they were the first publishers of Beckett's work, the French work translated into English. Pat Bowles had translated, I think, Molloy. And in any case, they offered to publish a collection of my stories, but I'd become so intensively paranoid that I couldn't really believe that they... I thought they were doing me some very generous and charitable favor. And I remember when Alex offered me that possibility, said, you know, they'd all met and just determined that the book was interesting and that would like to do it, and I couldn't believe him, so I subsequently published it myself.
How were you sustaining yourself during this period in France and on the island?
I had, my wife had one of those almost legendary small trust funds. I can remember $215 a month, which permitted one to delay, you know, absolute life commitment. And I lived in that respect for about 6 to 8 years in a kind of tacit fear. What in the name of heaven would I do if I didn't have that meager but real provision? And I remember my mother, who was a very dear and very sweet woman, saying, I like to think Bob could get a job if he had to. But I would convince myself writing. I really wrote incredibly. I must have written 8 hours a day in various ways, letters and whatever.
I would assume that your novel, The Island, which early novel of yours, reflected this period in your
life. It did indeed. It was an attempt, in some respects, to rehearse the emotional confusions and circumstances of that first marriage. Not to exercise it or simply to dump on it, so to speak, but to really to understand it or to get it to be, in some respects, something objectively clear to me as well as emotionally, this echoing impact. I happily have them. I saw my eldest son from that marriage, David, the eldest boy of that novel, I saw happily about 3 days ago. He's now professor of art history in Maine, in Orono, University of Maine, and a very sweet man, is momently to have his first child. So it's a lovely full circle. And for a long time, I was sadly separated from that family by virtue of legitimate or at least expectable bitterness. And so happily, in the last 10 or more years, we've come back into close rapport, which is very reassuring.
What took you to Black Mountain College?
The association primarily with Charles Olson that began really through letters. We were extraordinary classic pen pals. We were rehearsing senses of writing and activities relating. And presently our correspondence is being published, as it happens. And I think it's now in 6 volumes, and we have yet to get past the first 2 years. You know, it's a very dense and daily collection of letters. And we must have viewed, somehow, our not just our interests, but the occasion we, in each case, were for the other. Olson was obviously looking for someone he could rehearse his own thinking in relation to, sort of almost the old-fashioned sense, how does this sound, or what do you think of this? And I was the perfect listener for that time. I was living in this remote farm in New Hampshire, so that these letters were extraordinary to get. And I, on the other hand, needed someone to, again, as a sounding board, someone who'd say, this does seem to be working or that doesn't, or try this, try that. So it was an extraordinary friendship. For the first 5 years, it was entirely through letters. And then we met in Black Mountain for the first time, as it happens. I think correspondence begins about 1950 early, and then we didn't meet until 54, 4 years later.
And, he was head of the college?
Yeah, he was then the rector. He began as a teacher there in the late 40s.
The college, was that in Wilmington?
No, it was in just 10 miles east of Asheville, North Carolina. It was a curious location for this intensive, primarily experimental college of small numbers, having very diverse faculty over the years. People as Albers was the rector, then people as Eric Bentley and Alfred Kazin taught there briefly. Paul Goodman was there. A lot of extraordinary painters were in and out of the place, Klein and de Kooning. And then people like Buckminster Fuller and John Cage, Merce Cunningham. It had a very extraordinary array of diverse, both visiting and permanent faculty people. Then its students were equally dazzling. And Rauschenberg was a student there in the early 50s, Cy Twombly, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
What was your two-year tenure like at Blackmountain?
It was great. I'd been living, as I say, in this curious isolation of the farm community in New Hampshire, which was humanly very attractive, but no company for my interests in writing, let's say. And then we'd moved to France, where we were again isolated, except for very particular friends, and then to Mallorca, where my principal company was a friends we'd made a while in France, Martin Seymour Smith and his wife Janet. And then because of their relation to Robert Graves, he was part of that same company. And they were again very sweet and God knows friendly company, but they were not interested in American literature particularly. So the coming to Black Mountain, not only did I have the intensive interest, let's say, of people as Olson, but I also had the first experience of my own abilities, literally, that I could do something, that I wasn't just making it up out of whole cloth. And that was, today I am a man. It was almost that dramatic.
So you were teaching as well as editing the literary review.
Yeah. I was teaching, I think, one or two courses, I can't recall.
Quatrain?
But we were really taking a text such as Williams's later collected poems, let's say, and just reading it as carefully and intensively as we could. And we weren't trying to necessarily explain all the associations or references, but we were trying to determine how the mode of the statement was having this or that effect on our own experience of it. What was happening in the most basic and particular of ways in this writing. And I wasn't, as I say, trying to gain simply an objective experience of what it was as a construct verbally, but I was trying to see how it was working, how this was affecting us, and how that was seemingly being managed by the writing. And so then that, in turn, fed into, as one says, the situation of teaching writing. I was far more usually using texts of my own respect, or let's say the class's respect, in order to understand how things might be done or how you might do this to get this possibility of effect. I found that teaching their, trying to use only their writing often ended in too subjective and too emotionally loaded a circumstance. I preferred working with a writer they all more or less liked or certainly thought was interesting, and seeing how he or she did what seemingly he or she did do.
Why did the college fail?
Money, I think it was a very conservative time in not only in American education but in political thinking. It was very hard for any of these colleges, as Reed or Antioch or all of the smaller, more experimental schools, were having a hard time maintaining enrollments. And Black Mountain is almost the most, not fugitive, but the most most fragile of these schools, was having perhaps the worst time. Its enrollment when I got there couldn't have been more than 20 or 30 students.
And that's small.
Yeah, very small. Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah, very small. It had, the largest, I think, ever was something under 200, just after the war, thanks to the GI Bill, there was an increase of numbers, I think, that got up over 100 at one point. But basically, it was always quite small.
Well, we've heard the phrase, the Black Mountain Poets, but there are, reading someplace, the critic, maybe it was in the book catalog, Robert Wilson's, something to the effect that, the group was inaccurately known as the Black Mountain Poets. Straighten that out for me. Is there a group called the Black Mountain Poets?
There is a group called the Black Mountain Poets, primarily because of the title or the name or the label that Don Allen, I think an exceptional editor, he'd done a collection or an anthology in, I think, 1961-62 called The New American Poetry, and he determined to give it an order by qualifying various, or making various groupings of the poets thus included. Therefore, the New York School, for example, or the San Francisco group. The Beats, so to speak. And he dubbed a particular number of us the Black Mountain School, or whatever, calls the Black Mountain writers. And that association was primarily either we were variously teachers there, or else we had published in a magazine in Boston, from Boston, called Origin. Or we simply were an emotional company of friends. I think it was a misnomer just that our writing didn't, in fact, stylistically seem very similar. They were, one might say, we used, quote, a free verse prosody. We our poems looked in that respect, various lines and whatnot. But the actual economy of the writing and even the disposition of its commitments and interests was very diverse, and it would be impossible to, let's say, think of Robert Duncan's writing as being remarkably like mine, although we're lifelong friends, or Olson uses an extraordinarily long line, let's say. I use a very compact, I mean, my poems are very short, it's very long. Denise Levertov is different again. With her charming English background and whatnot, so that people would ask us persistently, why are you called Black Mountain Poets if you all write differently? Why do you even talk to one another? I think we all picked up very aptly on Pound's quotation of Remy de Gourmont, freely to write what one chooses is the sole pleasure of the writer. And we also felt that poetry, poems were most particularly authorized, or came most particularly from the emotional genesis, or the feelings that prompted them, or that sponsored them, so to speak, that the energy, however to call it, that which, quote, made poems, came primarily from the feelings that were there to be articulated. And the thing to be said effectually was discovered in its writing, not predetermined.
Robert Creeley, I hate to condense in the way I'm going to have to do it, last 20 or 25 years of your life, but we're almost out of time. But the college collapsed in the late 50s, and of course you maintain yourself as you didn't collapse, no, thank goodness. But you maintain yourself obviously as a teacher. And where did you, just in a nutshell, where did you go from there?
After Black Mountain, the first I taught in a boys' school in Albuquerque, New Mexico, of all places. And then went briefly to Guatemala, where I taught on a coffee plantation to the children of two plantations in English for 2 years. And then went from there to New Mexico and taught in university or college there. And I rather proudly say I've taught every grade except the sixth grade from the first through graduate school. And I like teaching. If it weren't, at times, the administrations and the social economic dispositions of education can get very bleak. But the basic act of teaching is a delight and an honor. It's an extremely happy thing to be doing. It feels very honest.
Teaching and turning out countless volumes of poetry.
Yeah, it's an old fathers and teachers and Whitman's great phrase. I seem to be stuck happily with being both very persistently.
Are you freezing in Buffalo?
No, we've just moved to northern Maine, lock, stock, and barrel. Not mid-coast Maine. That's where I've just come from. We've determined to have a house. Or my sister lives in Waldoboro, a really pleasant old town on the coast, and we've just renovated, rebuilt a house down the field from hers, and we hope to use that as home base, and then. My wife starts graduate school in Cornell this fall.
But you're still teaching at SU?
Yeah, I'm still teaching. Oh, yes, in Buffalo. That's where I'm from.
You also lived in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yes, we would go there summers for 2 years. That was our connection there. I liked that, indeed. It was a very, very curious old city. And we were living in a little town called Ogden, just north of Wilmington.
I'm not scholarly enough to, or analytical enough to be able to trace your development as a poet. But you have your collected poems from 1945 to 75. Perhaps you could tell me how you have seen yourself change from your earliest beginning as a poet to the mature Robert Creeley.
Well, I think one of the most real threads, or one of the most consistent patterns, is really the influence I took from Williams and his concept. Not only new ideas, but in things. But the poet thinks with his poem, and that lies his thought. That sense of the character of the writing, what it's trying to do, how to get said what must be said, that imagination of writing. Not confessional, again, growing up in New England, I'm shy of telling secrets simply to have them accepted, that really doesn't help all that much. But I certainly understand his lifelong commitment to trying to find particular ways of saying crucial contents of emotional circumstance, how to get said what must be said. So he stays a very deep and persistent model for me. And then, too, a writer as D.H. Lawrence certainly does, both in poetry and prose. My early loves were people as Lawrence and Dostoevsky and Coleridge and the classic Elizabethans and Williams and Pound, Gertrude Stein, and then this extraordinary company I've had as a writer, as Denise Levertov or Charles Olson or Helen Ginsberg or Edward Dorn or Michael McClure, many, many, Robert Duncan. It's been a delicious life in that company.
You say that, you've said a number of times in our chat that you write short, and that's true, but how do you justify almost one-line poems like, there's one called
there are
The
one.
Apple
it,
in Her
it
Eye.
It is probably the shortest poem I ever wrote is two words, it, it.
What does that mean to someone when you just write a little line like that?
I don't know. I thank God don't have to ask them.
Or justify it as far as that is concerned.
I remember one poem I'd written in a collection called Pieces that I had the audacity to include was, it's called A Piece, and it simply goes one and one, two, three. And people say, what in the name of heaven are you saying that for? What in the name of heaven is interesting about this one and one, two, three? I thought, well, one knows the characteristic progression, one, two, three, certainly, but I was always, one and one, add them, you get two. But then having two, you have paradoxically, you have a one and a one and a two, which in some curious way proposes the third case, which is three. And then I wasn't simply being wise about the reference or associations implicit, but those are very basic patterns for me. One is a very basic sense of person and identity, and two is certainly much otherwise. And having one and two, you have peculiarly three, which is all else. So that I was interested in the most compact proposal of it that I could think of, and that, like it or not, was what I came up with. And I also like the idea of as compact and contained a statement as I could manage, having still an emotional weight or authority to it.
Well, I become confused, not necessarily with your poetry, but with many poetry, because I don't understand, perhaps through my own limitations, what the poet is saying, or my own lack of knowledge about the poet himself.
Well, I think a great deal happens to any of us as readers, or when we've come through various educational patterns that tell us that poetry is something that's very hard to understand, and oftentimes it truly is. I know that as a teacher working with poets whom I much admire, much respect, as Pound, for example, or Eliot, you cannot say to a freshman that this is, quote, easy. It's not. It demands an extraordinary range of intellectual and literary information to understand much of what's being said at all. It's a specialist poetry in that respect. But it seems to me, if there's an emotional circumstance and or authority clear, that it can get across, so to speak, in the same way that I can hear people talking in various specialist circumstances. I mean, just walking over here through various construction crews, I can hear people talking about, get me that or the one. I can if I'm able to listen a bit, I begin to not simply, I don't understand that, you know, what tensile strength, I don't know that all the terms, obviously, but I certainly know the emotional human situation in which they're working after listening for a bit. And I do not like, in any use of language, a sense of exclusion. I hate circumstances that talk down to me, e.g. doctors on occasion. I respect the insistent need for clarity, for saying something in as explicitly accessible human terms as can be managed. The only alternative at times I've felt is that if the emotional terms are hard, e.g. in marriage or in any other kind of relationship, they can't be reduced to simplistic terms. They've got to have all that confusion and or diversity permitted also. That is, you can't say as simply as one sometimes presumes, quote, what's meant.
Well, Robert Lowell wrote so autobiographically,
yeah,
that until I read a lot of the books about Lowell, and indeed a whole cottage industry is
sprung up
around Lowell. On my bookshelf, I have almost all of Lowell's stuff, but I think that there are more analytical books about Lowell than Lowell would ever have anticipated.
He was ever
but they're helpful because it showed Lowell's frame of mind, and obviously he was a very confused man in many points of his life, and it explained a lot. I had a better conception about what he was trying to say, whereas before I enjoyed his things, but I didn't know what he was saying to me. I knew you could see that there was a man in anguish, but exactly. For example, he might ride in a taxi cab with someone and make a reference to it obliquely, and only his friends would know what he's actually saying.
I know. For example, I think he used, in the same way that an extraordinary singer might use his or her voice as a material for possible, you know, art, or painters might use a diversity of visual information in ways that would not be specifically located in the painting, but which that green of the wall, let's say, might come back in a painting that would have no person seeing the painting could possibly, know that specific wall. But in any case, I think a lot of the confusion, particularly about Lowell's later poems, is that he would seem to have used his daily life and the intimate associations of it, not unabashedly. I don't in truth think it ever occurred to him that it was a problem. He used it as a material for his writing. I think writers at times forget that this can affect the people they live with rather adversely. I know that in my own writing I've had that happen at times, and I can say that it never occurred to me. I never thought of it that way. I would use myself and others relating in ways that that was what I had to work with. That was the wood I had, or that was the material. So it never occurred to me there might be some other relation to it that would be hurt or dismayed by my use of it in this way. So I think that Lowell was very probably quite ingenuous in that use of those associations. What he is inevitably, I think, is an extraordinary master of a very, very canny and relaxed master of formal agency, which is always something I respect in him. And I like I admire immensely the way he's able to keep a sanity against all odds. I mean, I've had dear friends affected by mental illness, and Lowell's ability to return after these extraordinary bouts of mental illness is really something,
Robert Creeley, I'm going to have to cut this short. I have a 4 o'clock newscast to do, and either I do it or you're going to have to do it in poetic style.
We almost haste on.
I have to say that I am delighted that your material has been collected, because I was looking, I don't know if you've seen the catalog, Phoenix Bookstore catalog.
Oh, I know Bob Wilson did over the years.
Well, Lowell Cohn.
Yeah, I remember Lowell very well.
Lowell Cohn?
Sure.
Has collected all of your material, which is now in this catalog.
I think he's done it twice, actually.
Has he?
He sold his first collection some years ago. It seems to me he sold it to something like SUNY, and he decided to get rid of all his collection. The books were getting obsessionally dear to him. So he sold the whole thing, and then momently he sold, he started all over again.
Well, there are 3 pages of Robert Creeley books here.
Well, he's...
And without your collected material, it would be very difficult to try to put all this together.
I don't have
possible.
Them. I could encourage people by saying I certainly don't have them. Lowell has them, right?
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in. We've actually talked a little longer than I expected, but at the same time, not nearly long enough, and I wish I had more time to talk to you. And I'm